Got quite around here. Well, I went to help the brothers. We need to get our crops in. We all worked together, crews over to Horace's. Got over there and we only had one tractor between us. Got a 4-horse outfit, 3-horse outfit going. The tractor. We had another set of harrows that should be started. Some land needed harrowing. And 3 colts up on the hill. Big bay mare. We named Babe. Became one of the good horses he had. A couple other colts. Mel Gilbert wanted us to break them. Now, we broke a lot of horses in our day. And some of these guys thought that the Rollinses ought to break their colts. We used to get in on that every once in a while. Anyway, as we got lined out that morning, I took the sorrel mare out of the 4-horse outfit. We hooked this big bay mare in her place, brand new, put her on a jockey stick on the side. I took that sorrel mare and I took those other 2 colts that was up on the hill and we harnessed them up. I went and fastened me a seat on the harrows. Jerked those harrows around and hit them right straight up Horace's Hill. I tied those 2 young colts. I guess they was 3 years old. Never been hooked before to that sorrel mare. They turned me loose up that hill. And I'd go up that hill and they'd be just about ready to quit. And I'd turn them and head them down here. Julie came along, Rex Adams came in to see us. He and Wilma. They came over there and there she saw the boy she just married out on that arrow going full tilt with those 3 hood horses, just hard as they could go on a run. She wanted to know how long that been going on. Horace said, well, about all morning. He said, they're about to run down. He said, he about got them under control now. Well, she about had a fit. I couldn't imagine a woman worrying about that. This Rollins kid had done that all his life. One time over there, Horace got me to help him catch a colt to break its lead. And I caught that colt and tied it and he saddled the horse's tail and turned him loose. And up over that hill they'd go just hard as they could run. That's the finest circus ever seen. Where I got onto that trick was one day Howard asked me to come help him catch a colt. Caught the colt, tied that thing to Babe's tail. Big baby mare, we called Babe, turned them loose. When she got done with that colt, she could lead that colt anywhere. The first time I tried to lead it, the son of a gun pulled the rope right through my hands and dragged me around there just like I wasn't even in the business. Anyway, Reed sold out that spring, sold his farm to Owen, moved to Washington, to Walla Walla, got a job up there. Ariel was down here when I came home from getting married, so he got to meet Julia. Reed went back up with Ariel, got him a job, came down and got his wife, family. Went up to Schulberg, Howard Schulberg, said I'm moving to Washington. I'd like to rent your truck and I'll furnish the driver. Howard said, I assume the driver's Lynn. He said, yes. I drove that truck to Schulberg's all over the country anyway. So they come to some kind of an arrangement, and I don't know what it was, but anyway. Oh, we had the crops in, and we loaded up Reed and all his stuff in that truck. Took him to Washington, and this was kind of a trip for Julia and I. We hard and hardly wanted to go. Coming home, 4 of us in that cab, that truck. Got pretty weary. Coming home, we stopped at North Powder, where Jim last lived. Spent the night, and Jim only had one big old couch. time you put Howard and Harley and Julie and I on one couch. I was glad when morning come, we started down the road. But we've had a lot of trips, and that summer was, oh, the darn crops weren't very good. Our farm had kind of got run down. We got waterlogged, couldn't raise anything. Real hard to raise yeast to crop. Wireworms would come in. Everything you planted, they ate them up. Kind of a sad year, financially. Went to sugar factory, pay my bills. Keith Clayson and Gwelda were living in part of our house here. He was riding the bus going to school. Julia. Reading President Kimball's book, he said their baby was born 9 months and 9 days after they were married. Ray was born 9 months and 10 days after we were married. So we hit pretty close. And he was a welcome little boy. Little white-headed boy. Born the 12th of January, 1947. And then it was about the 15th of February that I went into hospital in Logan. Keith and Gwelda were here. I had a cow or two to milk. No one milked them for me while I was in the hospital. And I went down there and had my gallbladder out. And Julia lived with Theron and Wanda Hall. He was the boy from Eager, Arizona. She was from St. John's. She was on a mission, same time we were. She was in the Central States and in the same district under Alton Haslam. Julie stayed there and come up each day to the hospital to see me. Rayleigh Rogers was in the hospital with me, and he had a double hernia operation. We used to lay there and visit. I got pretty well acquainted with Rayleigh that week we were together. Everybody ought to have a session or two in the hospital. Takes away all your self-respect and all your, I don't know what. Now, Judy, I don't know how to word this. I'm going to have to tell the way it is, and you may have changed wording, but 2 days after they operated on me, they came in to change the dressing on the wound, on the incision. They split me right down here about 8 inches or 10, right down through the stomach. I've told about coming out of the anesthetic, a little bit about the operation, but I haven't ever told this part. When they pulled that new bandage on, they had me take a deep breath. And they pulled that satide, they shut the water off. It was kind of early in the morning, about 10 o'clock, I believe. By night, I had done everything I knew to get rid of the water pressure. And so finally I called the nurse in, the head nurse. It wasn't the regular nurse. The regular nurse had gone on a date. This was the next street. This was a married gal out there in North Logan. I've never seen her since, at least not to my knowledge. And I'm grateful for that. And, and I said, that darn doctor pulled that tape too tight and shut the water off. Now, I can't make it until morning without some relief. So she called up Dr. Craig, and he was a funeralist, and he said, oh, that darn kid shouldn't have trouble with his water. Go turn on all the water faucets and get him up. Pull that tape loose, then pull it back down. And the tape was in there. They couldn't get it. She couldn't get that tape back down. It was in about 2 inches of where he had it. So they got me up, and good land. I never heard of that in the hospital. And I sat on the edge of that bed. All I had on was that dang nightgown that didn't quite cover up all the essentials anyway. And I sat on that bed, and the sweat started rolling out of me. I could hear that water faucet coming, and then here come the water. And I was holding the can. And I got so shaky, I couldn't hold that can. And I hollered at that nurse, who was just standing out in the hall, waiting. I said, come here and hold this can. She said, that'll stop the water. And I said, nothing stopped that water, come hold that can. And old Rayleigh over there, and so she ran in there and knelt down in front of me, holding that can. And the water running out of me and into that can. And old Rayleigh over there in that bed. The laugh just killed him after that double hernia operation. He turned his head against the wall and held his mouth to keep from laughing, because it was just killing him. And there we was coming and feeling that can was getting fuller and the stream not cutting down any. And she said, I'll mop the floor if I have to, but don't stop. And I said, nothing stopped me, only running out of water. If you'd ever seen a can so full of water that it just arched up, that's just when I quit. And I crawled back into bed and laid there, and the last I knew, she was still standing there holding that can. It was full, she didn't know how to move it. But I was give out, and I went to sleep. When I come to, she was gone. So was the can of water. When Rayleigh heard me rouse, he said, then he had his composure. Said, someday I'll whip you for that, because I laid over here just dying. Want to laugh. I had to lay and turn my face to the wall not to see that, because that's the funniest sight I ever seen in all my life. Now this is, well, I haven't thought about that, but these hospital experiences are something else. As I got ready for that operation and we had things all lined up, and I got my friend Theron Hall, who lived there in Logan, Eager, Arizona, Frank Nielsen, to administer to me. They says, there's a lot of concern. As you get ready for an operation.
Judy, I've got to retape some of this right here. It didn't go on very good. Now, as you get ready for an operation, a lot of people are real kind. They come along to sympathize with you and tell you how many people died of that operation. And this particular operation, the procedure had just been improved, and a lot of people had died of it. Briggs Backman over in Trenton lost his wife in that operation. But they had to change their whole way of doing it. And anyway, when I went in the year before to get my physical, Dr. Cragen told me that they now had the procedure. Now let's see if this is taken. And so as I proceeded, I'd been administered to and I'm ready to go. As I came out of that operation, that darn nurse wanted me to drink some tea. And I thought that tea was the nastiest stuff that was ever put together. And I wouldn't drink it. Took a sip of it and set it back down and said, I won't drink it. She said, I'll report you to the doctor. And I said, well, that's just fine. You'll have to beat me to him. In a little while, he came in. And she said, he wouldn't drink his tea. And Dr. Craig said, I don't blame him. I wouldn't drink it either. It's the nastiest stuff in the world. So he said, let me see that sheet. And he took and wrote on there, feed him what he wants, when he wants, any time of the day or night. That nurse said, well, that's a terrible diet. And he said, now look, he's had some stomach troubles. And he knows more about what will fit in that stomach than either you or I. So do this instructions. Now, I hope this has covered the bad spot. I got by just fine in that hospital. I didn't have to have an enema. I mean, when the enema time come to get things going, I was able to make it to the bathroom, so I didn't use a bedpan. And this was real good. I was glad to get rid of that old gallbladder. Tedbrun Heisel was an intern at the D Hospital, and he came up and watched that operation, and he told me afterwards, he said, Lynn, that gallbladder, I don't think ever did work. He said, I can see why you had a lot of trouble. That was a constant, that was just an old sore. That wasn't a gallbladder. And I was glad to have Ted there. And gosh, I'd wait a long time. If they'd had that procedure a few years quicker, well, I could have avoided a lot of things, probably. Maybe even finished my mission. What not. Okay. I got along real well in that operation, and gosh, that was a good thing. I came home and recovered real fast and laid around here and kind of made it through the winter and got ready for spring. And that darned old gallbladder, those old gallstone tacks, they were real severe. And I used to wake up at night, in the middle of the night, and thinking I was having one. A long time, my system had been used to those for a long time. It was a long time getting rid of them. And I went along for 20 years, just before Glenn went on his mission. I had to go back in and have another operation. Dr. Broadbent did at that time. Adhesions had come in and shut off the gall duct. In my land, that was quite a thing. They had a drain in me, and I wandered around that hospital for 3 weeks, I believe. That was a kind of a long deal. I discovered that time I was in there that I was allergic to Demerol, which is a hypo. Every time they'd give me a Demerol hypo shot, I'd just vomit for an hour or two and then be ready to give me another. So the nurse recommended that I change, tell the doctor this, because I wasn't near enough to get over it. Dr. Broadbent came in and he said, you're still vomiting. I said, every time they give me a hypo shot, I vomit till I get another one. He said, well, we'll switch you to morphine, and after that I quit vomiting. Coming home, and my health improved then. Let's see what's going on.
So that's the kind of the way I've been. I build up a simple diet here, no roughage, you can stand the roughage, take it. And do more than tripping most of the time. Get married.
Judy, right in here I've got a bad spot in this tape. And I can't tell what I got on there at this time. So if you just go ahead and go through it, and do what you can. Then when it's typed out, maybe I can fill it in now. So I'll just leave it as is, and get what you can, and we'll go from there.
Well, I just turned 19, I just turned 28 years old. I keep the January in about a week, so after that, when we get that out of it, here to chasing a bunch of kids around playing ball. I was over here at school playing ball with kids. Milton Jorgensen, my counsel, he congratulated me on my new church call. I looked at him. I said, Milt, I knew there were some vacancies in the presidency of the 70s Corps, but I didn't know that I was to fill it. I guess there was just one vacancy. And he turned red and said, I'm sorry. He said, I'm sure President Heyer said he'd talk to you. And I said, well, I've dealt with President Heyer all my life. He was in the bishopric. When I was a deacon, he came in the bishopric. He was in the bishopric, sent me on a mission. He was the stake president not too many years ago, signed my recommend, interviewed me. Let me get married in the temple. I've done everything he's ever asked me to do. I don't think there's any worry on his part. And that's all right, don't worry about it. If it don't happen, well, I won't accuse you of transgression or shed any tears. I came home about this time of the year, about the time Glenn was born. I bought a car, that first car we'd had, Julie and I'd had. It was a Model A Ford. Oh, it was a good car, liked it. That was our first car. Cars at the end of the war was darn expensive, but I give Norris Hyde $150. It's that I just happened to have that much money. So we went to conference. I went over Saturday night, sitting there, priesthood session of conference. President Heyer ran up to me and said, hey, Lynn, we need you to work in the 70s Corps. Will you work? And I said, yeah, I'll do what you want. He said, I thought you would. So I think it was after the noon session, after the morning session. Must have been the afternoon session. A young apostle who hadn't been in the quorum very long, by the name of Spencer Kimball, interviewed me and set me apart as one of the presidents of the 7th Quorum 70. A job I held for 10 years. I counted up one time and I believe I worked with 14 men in that assignment. And we got a lot of things done in that quorum, but that was a good experience. Jid land, we'd wrangle things around, you wouldn't believe it, and we'd finally come up with a working solution. One of the first parties I went to, I'd been a 70 ever since I went on a mission. As Anton Ivins interviewed me for a mission, he ordained me a 70. That was back in the fall of 1940. So I'd been a 70, a little better than 7 years. I had filled a mission. I later filled a stake mission. No, I filled a stake mission. Guess I was a stake missionary when they put me in the presidency. So I'd filled a foreign mission, a full-time mission, and I'd filled a stake mission. Heard a bunch of kids playing Explorer Ball and MM Ball and so forth. And always taught Sunday school class. Well, put me in prison for 7th Corps. I didn't quit all these other jobs. I kept up with them too. Gosh, we had a party not long after I was in there. And I saw where the blood of Israel ran pretty deep in that bunch. We fed everybody what they wanted first and sold them the seconds, and that just about broke my heart. So I thought that over, and the next time when we met, I said, now look, brethren, I can't do this. My golly, let's run this quorum on a on a basis of whatever. But when we invite those core members and their partners, let's feed them. And let's not be selling them seconds. That just breaks my heart. I can't do that. So I talked them out of it. We developed up, we used to have a couple of parties a year. One time, and then about once a year long in the summer, we'd take a Saturday afternoon and go somewhere, the presidency, and the clerk, and our wives. We'd go somewhere for a party. I remember one time, just as we were getting ready to go, Grandpa Whitney, this was Luke Whitney, his wife had died, mother's grandmother had died, and he had remarried. Now, Brother Whitney wasn't sealed to his first wife. She had been married to his uncle, a little older. She often said she lived 12 years with one husband and 50 years with another one. But anyway, him and his second wife came, and she'd been a widow for 30 years. We were just going to go to a party down in Mack Park in Smithfield, presidency and her wife on Saturday afternoon. We'd made arrangements for some baby tender, don't know who it was, but anyway. In come Grandma and Grandpa. We just put them in the car and said, come go with us. So we went down there. We were sitting around there, eating our dinner, stirring around. It was kind of potluck. And Faber and Heisel always had one of the most favorite sayings. When he's doing something that was real difficult to do, gosh, that's just like making love to a widow. You can't overdo it. He made that statement, and she had been a widow, Grandma had, for 30 years. And she looked at me and winked and laughed, and I laughed and laughed and laughed. I just about died. Funny Faye sidled around there to me, and he said, what did I say wrong? And I said, that lady right there married Grandpa just a month or so ago. She'd been a widow for 30 years. Oh, he said, why didn't you hit me? And I said, I didn't do any good. Wouldn't done any good. And I laughed at that. Faye didn't use that statement so often after that. He was a little more fussy where he said it. But working with these 70s was one of the finest. Well, working with those old 70s was one of the finest church jobs I ever had. I held that for 10 years. Now, I got to go back here to another story. It happened, I think, when Glenn was about 2 years old. I guess we had Nada. I can't remember which year Nada was born. Anyway, got a call one night down Logan. Esther Sullivan called Julia and said, Julia, did you know that Rondy, they called him, Tober, was in the hospital and real bad? So we rushed down there to see him. Now, Rondy and Carrie lived out in Tabiona. Let's see if we're straight here. He taught school out in Tabiona, and Carrie's mother was a widow and lived in Logan. They'd come in that spring to see her, and he took sick. Well, I rushed him to Budge Clinic. Wendell Budge was a member of that clinic, and he started out his doctoring up here in Lewiston. And he took out every time anybody got anything wrong with them, they always took out their appendix. Didn't make any difference what it was. There was a saying that was quite famous here in Lewiston for many years. Appendicitis was called budgeitis. I hope I don't get sued for this story, but anyway. They rushed him in and took out his appendix. And when he came to, he said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "You cut in the wrong place. You didn't get the job done. It still hurts, not where you cut, but where this other place." Oh, they didn't believe him. And a week later, when I ran onto the story, they had finally discovered that it was a kink bowel in the first place. Well, I guess doctors, about like mechanics, are entitled to mistakes. But Wendell made one on my mother. She went to him, didn't feel good. He just took her blood pressure instead of giving her a thorough examination. And often this was the situation. Doctors in a hurry. Medicine has improved a lot over the years, so forth. But anyway, he gave her some medicine to take the acid out of her stomach. I don't know, somebody told me that cancer didn't grow very good in an over-acid stomach. And that cancer just went on a rage that day till she died. And this always used to harrow up my soul a little bit. I believe I've since repented. But anyway, Wendell was the one that operated on him, and Wendell was the one, when I got back there, they just operated on him for the kink bowel, and gangrene had set in, and they took about everything out of him that they could take. And sewed him up, and I was a paper boy to Wendell Budge. Used to deliver papers when he first came here in Lewiston, and I knew Wendell, and I tangled with him over my mother's health. I hadn't seen him. Every year when I went to the sugar factory, he'd generally come along and pull me out of line and visit with me a few minutes. He tried his best to make amends, and I believe maybe he did, but anyway, when they called the family in, tell them how bad Ron was, I was there. And I was a little bit spicy, I guess. Because I had administered to Rondi the night before, and he told Carrie after I left that he said two men had come and gotten me and were dragging me down a hall. And I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay here. I wanted to stay with you. And I was fighting not to go. And I heard Lynn's voice came out through that spacious building I was going through, just as clear as a bell. And they stopped and said, "You can now go back." And he lived about a week, I believe. Anyway, Dr. Wendell Budge was telling what had happened. Sorry some of these things had happened, but this is just the way it was. He wasn't able to tell it, but they had sewed him up, and he didn't understand why the man lived. He'd never seen a man in this kind of condition still alive. Well, I knew why the man lived. As I administered to him, he just couldn't see him leaving that wife and those three little kids. No, I had a couple of three little kids this time, and I, golly, I didn't want to leave them to anybody else, and so I get in on a discussion with him. He and I went back and forth there, and Carrie was about half sick, thought that she didn't have much hopes of her husband living, and she didn't want to be a widow all those years. And his mother was all upset, and Grandma Tobler. And I just coaxed the family. And I told Wendell, and I ended up, and I said, "I know why the man lives, Wendell. He lives in spite of you, not because of you." Now, it looks like to me it was a royal mistake. The man lives. Let's call some other doctors in. He said, "I've called some other doctors in." I said, "Who'd you call?" He told me, and I said, good crime, Nate. They're all a member of your clinic. If they knew you'd made a mistake, they wouldn't dare tell you. They wouldn't dare tell you how to do it. But it was the policy of the doctors that you couldn't call another doctor in until you had legally taken the patient from that doctor. And I coaxed Carrie and Grandma Tobler. They said, how will we tell them? But anyway, it didn't get done. Now, as I was walking out of that hospital one night, I'd taken Julia down there, and she was going to stay with him. Somebody had to stay. I had to work tomorrow. Dr. Cragen walked up behind me, and he said, Lynn, I saw Julia up here in the hospital. What's the matter? I said, she's got an uncle up here dying of bunchitis. And Cragen says, not snoring loud. There's a couple of those guys following me. What's the matter with you? But anyway, over in the Clarkson Cemetery, not long after, we buried Ron. I had spoken at a funeral when I was on a mission. But this first funeral I'd spoken to since come home. That was real hard. Now, Grandpa, they wanted Fenton Whitney, your mother's dad, to talk. A few people from down that way coming. It was kind of bad weather. It was raining. I think it was long middle of June, I believe. She lined up all the program, and she had me on air. And the family hadn't got here the night before. Tobler family scattered all over the West. Carrie said, now, Lynn, we'll proceed with that funeral tomorrow, and if they don't show up, you lengthen your sermon, you've got the whole job. I appreciate their confidence. As I've got into this funeral speaking over the years, I'm not orthodoxed. I don't get up and tell them what a fine man they are, a fine person. I leave that to the other people. Everybody knows that. I tell about the death and the resurrection. I go right into the gospel. I get in as deep as I can wade. But anyway, we've enjoyed carrying our kids over the years. We check up on her every once in a while. She's a real fine gal. She's done a good job with her kids. She sent the first missionary in the Tobler family in that generation. And also of her mother, of her dad and mother's family, the first one of that generation was hers that went on the mission. The only one of that generation, I believe. When they come to the next generation, that's what we were in. Our kids were in. There's been a lot of them going that next one, but she's done a good job with her kids. She lived here widow all these lives. Taught them. Lived up Preston. We associated with her and really enjoyed her.
Now, I thought of another story today as I sit on the stand. I'm having a little trouble getting this on here about right. Max Gregory was there to bless his baby, and let's see how this is taken.
What about this?
As I saw Ted sitting down in the audience, Ted and Bob were there to help him. I remembered along here when Ted and Rex were little boys. Rex got killed some years ago while in the service. Killed in an airplane wreck, I believe, in Turkey. Anyway, I had a few cows around here and a few calves and a little corral. Run around here working with somebody all day and run farm at night and so forth. Milking cows early and late and whatnot. Trying to make a living. And a darn stray calf showed up here. And I thought probably it was Seth Gregory's. So I just sewed it in the corral and let it stay there. I was going to tell him next time I seen him, and gosh, I didn't see him. And it went on for a month or 6 weeks, something like that. I saw Seth one day, and I said, did you lose a calf? And the guy, he said, where is that? And I described it, and he said, yeah, that's it. I said, well, I throwed it in that trail of mine, and so come get it. Well, he sent those two little boys after it, and that wasn't really fair. They was good kids. And that was the only calf that ever lived. And I turned that calf out, and that calf had run over those kids. And they'd try to drive it, and they couldn't drive it, and they'd just turn around and run right over them. They were just about to bawl. And I said, ah, oh, put it back in the corral. And they began to cry, and oh, our dad'll just skin us if we don't bring that calf. And I said, oh, good criminy. You just go and tell him I won't let you have it. Now, you don't have to go through all this nonsense. You just tell him that, and don't worry about it. He won't get after you. Well, next morning, Seth came up, and he looked at me, and he didn't know how really to start that sermon. And he said, the kid said you wouldn't let him have the calf. And I said, Seth, those are good kids. And that's the only calf that ever lived. That I turned that calf out and run right over those kids. Now, I'll never let those kids have that calf, but I'll let you have it. That's a job for a man. And he said, turn it out. So he turned it out, and he took after that calf. He got him a club, and he beat on that calf, and that calf turned around and ran right into him. I don't know who was the tired this time he got that calf on. Then he tied it up, and the dang thing died. And he said, at least that died at birth. And I thought of that. This, I want to matter. And he said, turn it up. Well, Judy, seems like one of the next events come along was when we got ready for NADA. On the spring of the year, and we had our crops in, expecting her last of May, it seems like. I don't know. No, it was last of April, first of May. Last of April. And my land, when your mother decided to have a baby, well, you had to be there. We get out of the hospital, and Dr. Hansen was the doctor. As Nada was about to be, as when Nada was born, why, your mother hemorrhaged, and gosh, I was so pleased that we had her in the hospital. And but oh, that was a welcome girl in the house. By golly, we welcomed them all as they come, and we just, your mother was out kind of half loony with the anesthetic, and she'd say, what did we get? And I said, you got a little girl. And she said, no, I don't believe that. We've got another boy. And I said, no, doctor told me that was a girl. And we had this little girl. My golly, big brown-eyed girl, and we were sure glad to have her. And then the next year, she come along just fine, and then Jed come along a year later, 11 months later, and always said what stunned Jed was that when he crawled along on the floor, Nader rode him as a horse. I guess that's what stunned him, I don't know. But here we was with the four kids, and I don't know, I'd got into a deal with the sugar factory and rented them my place for a year if they'd pay the taxes on it and level it. Well, they were supposed to provide me a job, but they made it so cussed miserable I had to quit. And so I went down to Ogden and worked on a construction company with Robert E. McKee. And they put me in labor foreman. That's the worst job you ever had, get a bunch of burnouts and trying to get work out of them. And so I switched to a carpenter, and then they fired me. And then they laid me off for the winter. And I was out of work that winter, and oh my land. I couldn't find a job, and unemployment wasn't quite enough money. And so Julia went down and went to work at Mow Today, and I tended those four kids. Now, Ray tells it that all we lived on was bread and milk, and I don't believe that, but then that's his story, and it's long enough ago that I can't prove it, I guess. But none of them had gone to school, and wasn't any of them old enough to go to school. Good criminy. Me tending those kids all day, and I'd walk down to the barn or walk uptown, get my nerves calmed down, as long as winter ever spent. And golly, and Julia down Mow Today sewing and run the sewing machine all day, and she spun around one day on the road down there and run off the road with the car and scared her half to death. And I decided that if she had to work, well, we had to do a better job than that. She'd have to have a better job than that, because I didn't pay enough money, and that wasn't the right place to have her work, at least. If you're going to work, you might as well make more money than that. And she quit the next spring, and I went to drilling beets for the sugar company. They had a drill, and I rented the drill. I went down and said, I'd rent your drill. And Dale Smith, the manager, said, no, we'll rent to us, up to you. Same price. And so I run that drill each spring for until it wore it out, and then I bought a new one and run it. And I guess it was, most of the drills were horse drills ahead of that, but that was a pretty good drill. And I used to drill beets in the spring and work the sugar factory in the fall and milk a few cows. But it couldn't get going fast enough. Our family was coming along fast. I couldn't make enough money to do it. Well, then Judy come along, and the fall, while Julia was carrying Judy in the fall, Judy was born in March. I think it was along in October. Oh, her legs just about killed her. She just couldn't walk. And so Dr. Scablin, he and Dr. Craig operated on her and pulled out those varicose veins. And we'd fasted that morning, and we'd got to have a procedure in the family that when somebody was being operated on, we fasted that morning while the operation was going on, had matter prayer, and I seemed to get along better. Anyway, I made arrangements for those kids, and I think Ray and Glenn were both in school. Had Nate and Jed here, and I don't know what I did with them, but anyway, time I got the kids off school and these other two saturated around, then I got down there, and they had got through operating on Julia, but she was just dead to the world. Dr. Scablin said, we give her so much pentothal, and she was still kicking. And I don't know when she'll ever wake up, but well, I stayed with her, and it was time for the kids to come home from school, so I came back home, and let's see if this is coming on right. I came back home, got the kids from school, and give them their supper, and got them all sashayed around, and got somebody to tend them, and turned around and went back to hospital. And when I got back there, that meant she'd been asleep from noon till, well, I got through the operation about noon. I came in her room. That's the first time I ever seen her drunk. She just waved her hand and said, "Oi!" Seen Julia drunk was something else. Never seen that before. Anyway, my criminy, her tongue was loose from both ends and it just rattling on. She knew what she was saying, but she didn't really care. Well, they got her up that next morning and walked her around because they didn't want her getting blood clots or anything. And they kept moving her around. And when I brought her home, why, she slept. She'd been so tired. She hadn't slept in weeks, months, I guess. I'd get her up in the morning. She had to walk so far a day. And I'd get her up in the morning. We'd have breakfast and get those two kids off to school. Nate and Jed play around here, and she'd go back to bed and sleep. I'd get her up at noon when I'd come in from work. And then she'd stay up till we'd have dinner, and then she'd go back to bed. When I'd come home at night, well, I'd get her up, and we'd have supper, and then she'd go back to bed. In the morning, I'd get her up. And it went on about 2 weeks this way before she got rested up. They didn't dare just leave her in bed. They had to keep her moving. They didn't want blood clots in those legs. But the next spring, when it come, we had to try two hospitals in two states to get Judy. First thing that ever happened on Julia when she got ready to have a baby was the ladder broke, and then we took her to Logan on Judy, and she stayed there in 2 days, I believe. Dr. Scabrun said, I've got to operate tomorrow night. The next day, he said, why don't you, we take her home? If you're going to be home? And I said, yeah, I'll be there. And we get very far away. We took her home. She was homeless all day. And that night after supper, well, he called me and said, well, I'm ready to go up to the hospital, and I'm going to stay there all night. And I've got to operate in the morning. Well, so we went up to the hospital and put her in bed. And he said, now, look, Lynn, I'm all ready, and I'm going right over here and lay down in this room. Now you sit there with her, and when you need me, you come get me. All right, that was the agreement I had. And I'm sitting there talking to her, and this was our fifth baby. And holy dear, she grabbed the head of that bed and said, get that doctor. And I went over and jerked that door open, and he was on bed, and I jerked him out of bed, and he was halfway across that room as he was waking up. They never did change beds with her. Judy was born. That was early enough in the night. So there was our Judy. And I believe they must have done something to the water system. Because March that year, Judy was born, the 2nd of March, and the next year in April, Neil was born. And the next year at Memorial Day, Craig was born, and the next year at December the 10th, Mark was born, and the next year, good land. And the next year at Christmas, day after Christmas, Nancy was born. This was quite a circus. I was at Thiokol at that time. And we had Julie up Preston in the hospital with Nancy. And we took Nada and Mark up to stay with Carrie through the holidays. And Nancy and Nancy, and Nada tended Mark. Nada was a good baby tender. Now, I heard of the rest of the kids down here for Christmas, now, for the rest of the holidays. Now, we'd had Julie here for Christmas, and then rushed her up there the day after, and had Nancy. And then a year from the coming February was Gary was born, and that ended out to be the last one of our family. I got to go back here now and In about 1956 or 57, one of those years, I borrowed a lot of money. I bought the, when Jed was a baby, I guess it was, I bought that farm out, what we call out on the creek. I bought that from Faber and Heisel for $6,750. Bought it on contract. Each year I'd give him a little money and the interest. That kind of doubled our operation. And that made it that I had enough land then that I could borrow from the Farm Home Administration to buy me a herd of cows. So we built this cow shed down here on the barn and started milking about 25 cows. And we get along pretty good for a couple of years, but 58 was a bad year. Milk prices weren't very good, feed was high. Had a lot of trouble, and they had condemned my setup. In 59, I had deliberated this decision with all my heart. Oh dear. I couldn't see how that the size of family I had, and don't any of you ever think that I complained about the size, how in the world was I going to finance them? Now, Ray and Glenn were just as good a help. They were just kids. But they'd do just as much work as any man. And they were dependable. So Lorne Rogers and I, in the summer in July of 1959, went out to the employment office in Logan and filled out an application and took an aptitude test for Thiokol. And about in August, they called me up to come out for interview. And I went out for interview and they hired me as of the 14th of September as a lab technician. And so we cut back a little on the cows. Me and the kids had milked those cows. When I was on swing shift, they'd milk them. And sometimes they'd milk, sometimes I'd milk, and it worked just fine. But along here, and so I was out to Thiokol when Nancy was born, and I'd been out there from September till December. And I remember they passed a ruling out there, it's company policy, that if you was off sick a day before a holiday, you didn't get the holiday's pay. So as I went back after the holiday, somehow or another we was off the day that Nancy was born, because of the holiday, I think, was on Sunday or something. So they give us Monday to take its place. I don't know, anyway. Can't remember which day it was, but so when I handed my supervisor, Jim Crawford, the candy board, he said, "What day do you bring your wife and baby home?" And I said, "The day before New Year's." And he turned to his secretary and he said, "You call that outfit up and tell him that he's going to be off